Hi, I'm Doug White, and it is episode 269 of the Security Weekly News on Friday in the week of 22 January 2023. We've got empathy, hacking back, typo squatting, Bitwarden, Lexmark, Exchange, Russians, Iranians, Dragon Bridge, and who knows what all else. Derek Johnson joins us to talk about the Hive ransomware targeting by the FBI. All that and more on the Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
How is your business staying one step ahead of cyber criminals? Secure your email, applications, network, and data with Barracuda. Protect your business and go from zero to security in no time flat. Whether your team is working in one location or many, Barracuda has solutions that are easy to buy, deploy, and use. Learn how Barracuda can protect your business against ransomware, phishing, and other cyber attacks. Visit securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. Barracuda, your journey secured. All right. Welcome to Security Weekly News. So a joint federal alert in the United States indicated that a successful hack had occurred against two federal civilian executive branch entities. That's called the FCEB and their networks. And it was tied to typo squatting. So this is, you know, a thing. Criminals adapt to the training that we do. And we've taught people to look carefully at the URLs, look carefully at the links and all this stuff. So typo squatting becomes a thing. And if you don't remember what typo squatting is, it's, you know, it's where you take a very similar or visibly similar domain and it's used to pose as something else. And which is how I ended up owning Hot Horse. And my domain Hot Horse has slashes through the O's because Larry Pesci and I were talking about that on Security Weekly once. And I bought that domain so I could put it in a browser window and you can't see the slashes through the O's. So if you were actually trying to go to the real hothorse.com, you would actually get to my site. There's not one. Or if there is, don't go there because I don't want to think about what it might be. The targets in this case were legitimate remote monitoring and management software, RMMs, which is things like LogMeIn. CISA found the breaches back in October, and the first instance, they said, appeared in mid-June of last year and started with phishing emails that included a phone number for an FCEB employee, so spear phishing stuff. If you called that number, then it took you to a domain called myhealthcare.online, which then attempted to get you to download legitimate RMM software like LogMeIn. I don't know what they were using, but stuff like that. And well, you know, once you let somebody log in through LogMeIn, they pretty much control the whole system and they can do whatever they want. It's a really common and effective approach because people call, and they do this all the time for both individuals and organizations, but targeting federal agencies or whatever is easy enough to do. Their phone numbers are published. You can call people. You can gather all kinds of OSINT. So you might want to remind your employees of your policies about this and that even though they've been trained to look at these, you know, URLs and so forth, you got to look really, really carefully. And even then, it may not be enough because this is obviously effective. Well, LastPass had their problems, and now Bitwarden and other password managers are also being targeted in a Google ad phishing campaign. Most of the password managers are cloud-based, and so they probably store your password somewhere in a vault. Some of them store it locally on your machine. Some of them store it in the cloud and so forth. But the problem starts when you have a master password. And you have to have a master password because even the password management companies haven't figured out a way around that. And of course, you know, that password, that master password ends up being the weakest link in the entire chain, because if somebody gets a hold of it, it doesn't really matter where the passwords are stored if they can recover them using your master password. So basically that gives them the whole vault. On Tuesday, Bitwarden users were hit with an ad called Bitwarden Password Manager. So it's a kind of typo squatting-y looking thing. It looks a lot like it, but it's a little bit different. The domain itself was at bitwarden.com, and it basically just another typo squatting attack like that first story. And if you clicked it, it redirected you to another domain called bitwardenlogin.com. So they're buying up every component of those names around the actual name. So I guess companies are going to have to be like politicians and buy every single possible iteration that could involve them, like, you know, hey, DougWhiteSucks.com or whatever. But it did look like the Bitwarden Web Vault login page. And of course, if you typed your master password into that, well, to use a technical term, that would be bad. So, you know, I know using password managers is nice, and it encourages you to use different passwords on every site and even tracks that kind of stuff. And they can even generate very strong passwords for your use when you need them. But that master password is the nuclear launch code. So it really has to be very strong, and it needs to be very well protected. You need a very complex passphrase. It needs to use multi-factor authentication. And, you know, if it doesn't do those things, or you use the same password you've used somewhere else, it's very much at risk. But remember, even with multi-factor, SMS can be hijacked, overlay attacks work, SIM swapping attacks work, all kinds of ways of targeting that multi-factor that can still let somebody get through. They were also talking about advanced adversary in the middle attacks, which these are basically, you log into the fake site, the site steals your credentials and the MFA session cookie, and then they can reuse those things later. So be really careful out there as you use your password managers, and make sure you protect that master password. Microsoft issued a warning yesterday to advise customers to patch their on-premises Exchange servers and apply the latest cumulative update, which would allow Microsoft to continue deploying additional emergency updates if they need to. This is an attempt to roll up the out-of-band security updates they've been issuing regularly, trying to deal with all the proxy login, proxy not login, proxy shell, and all the other vulnerabilities that have recently come to light in Exchange. Shadow Server Foundation reported this month that they found over 60,000 vulnerable Exchange servers exposed online, which were vulnerable to proxy not shell. Shodan Search revealed thousands of Exchange servers exposed, which were vulnerable to proxy shell and proxy login issues still. So patch these things. Come on. And they put a nice cumulative update out there so you can do it all in one big whack. So just take the weekend and say we're doing it. Lexmark released a firmware update for a severe vulnerability, which led to remote code execution on more than 100 printer models. The vulnerability is a server-side request forgery in the, guess what, web services feature. Boy, everybody's regretting putting those nice, convenient web GUIs up so that you could, you know, manage your printer, manage your Cisco equipment, all these kind of things. They did say there was no evidence that the exploit was currently active in the wild, but a proof of concept code has been published, which means that it soon will be. The article contains a full list of printers and firmware that you can review if you have Lexmark printers or Lexmark derivative printers in your site. A couple of things to tell you about that. Make sure your printers are not exposed any more than they need to be, in particular those web interfaces. And, you know, even your internal employees may say, hey, I can take advantage of this and get free printing or whatever. And don't forget the firmware and patches on peripherals, which is a very easy thing to neglect. Let me tell you from experience that, you know, I remember managing lab sites that had hundreds of printers, and, you know, nobody ever even thought about checking those printers to see if they had vulnerabilities in them, and we did have people use that. The United Kingdom Cybersecurity Center, NCSC, issued a warning that Russian and Iranian state-sponsored hackers are increasing targeting of organizations and individuals. The agency said that a spike in spear phishing attack had been attributed to Cyborgium, and TA-453, Cyborgium is Russian, TA-453 is Iranian. And they apparently had the objective of gathering information about the victims for further targeting. They said that it did not appear the two groups were collaborating on this. It's a tried and true technique, right? I think the North Koreans started it. Cyborgium is a Russian state-sponsored group that had been targeting NATO countries last summer until Microsoft acted to disable their online accounts being used. And T-453 or APT-42 is believed to be part of the Revolutionary Guards in the Iranian Armed Forces. They have been impersonating journalists in the past, and they've targeted academic experts and policy experts in the Middle East with this approach. The report said they are currently using open source information to build out their bait, and then they collect information from LinkedIn and so forth. Fake accounts they've set up then impersonate experts or journalists, and they approach you that way. And then once they do that, they target you with emails. They mimic those legitimate domains that look like what they're, you know, supposedly from. And then once they've established a relationship with you, they send you some sort of malicious link, and which will get you to give up your email account creds. And once they do that, what they've been doing is they jump in there and they set up forwarding so that any emails you receive or send are automatically forwarded in the background to them. So you don't know they're doing it. So, you know, be careful out there. Government people have been heavily targeted by this, because obviously if they can read your mail and the mail you send, that's a big problem. Google Tag has exposed thousands of fake news videos which have been posted by the pro-China group Dragon Bridge. I don't know if they're located in China, but they probably are. More than 50,000 spam fake news stories and other content were posted by that group. Dragon Bridge ran disinformation campaigns all across all the Google-owned platforms like YouTube, Blogger, and AdSense. Meta and Twitter have also removed fake content from the China-based group. More than 100,000 accounts have been terminated by Google since 2019 that were directly related to Dragon Bridge. Over 50,000 YouTube channels last year were identified and disabled by that. So these guys work hard. Apparently, though, despite all their hard work setting up 50,000 YouTube channels, they didn't have much success, because 53,000 of the 53,000 YouTube channels, 58% had zero subscribers and 42% of the videos had zero views. I mean, you know what those things are like, right? When you click on something like that and you go, oh, come on. But Google did say the group is very persistent and they're very adaptable. So they are now apparently producing talk show format videos and high quality beauty advice and cooking tip shows to try and attract viewers. I mean, now understand, this kind of propaganda has been being done in all directions since the dawn of time. And, you know, world powers have been doing this stuff on all sides. So not just, you know, supposedly bad countries or whatever, all countries have been doing it. You know, Pravda, if you remember that, People's Daily. China used to publish a weekly magazine. I used to actually get that magazine because I was trying to practice reading Chinese, and it, you know, and but it was filled with propaganda. I mean, and I actually got asked about it once on a security clearance. They were like, why do you subscribe to this? I was like, oh, I just like to practice reading Chinese, and this is a bunch of crap, but, you know, it has nice pictures. But, you know, that kind of stuff. So be careful what you take to be truth in these complex times. Well, the FBI targeting Hive ransomware story was pretty much everywhere this week, and the U.S. also reiterated a $10 million bounty on the head of Tim McCracken. Oh, sorry, on ransomware gangs, not Tim McCracken. There was only $100 placed on the head of Tim McCracken, and if you don't get that reference, look it up. But Derek Johnson, who's a senior editor and reporter at SC Media and wrote the story about this, joins us to talk about the story. Derek covers major hacks, cybersecurity policy, and other cross-cutting issues in the public and private sectors, and before that spent 4 years writing and reporting on cybersecurity policy and the federal government at Federal Computer Week. Hi, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what's going on with this Hive story? I mean, I mean, everybody, this was everybody's headline, the FBI shutting down Hive ransomware. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, so this the news of this originally broke yesterday morning when a number of folks noticed that the Hive ransomware leak site had been replaced by a notice saying it had been seized in a coordinated law enforcement action. But the seizure of those websites and other assets actually took place on January 11th. And it all kind of stems back from the fact that the FBI was apparently in Hive's network and had infiltrated their network as far back as July 2022. So that gave them access to three email addresses that they then traced to three different servers, two of them in the US in Los Angeles, another one in the Netherlands. That were associated with those email addresses. One of those servers was a backup redundant server that had access to the Hive's leak site, as well as their victim negotiation portal. The other US-based server was a back-end server that actually connected to Hive's broader network and infrastructure. It had records of communication between different Hive members, malware hashes. It had information on at least 250 Hive affiliates. And so apparently what the FBI had been doing these past 6 months was squatting in Hive's network, stealing decryption keys for specific intrusions, and then passing them along to victims, and then eventually shutting down those servers, shutting down those websites, seizing the servers, and kind of coming out and doing a big sort of press conference about it. So this was a really interesting story for a lot of reasons, but I'll kind of let you ask a question or two and see if I can answer it there.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm really happy to see that law enforcement, you know, I mean, I remember when we first started dealing with this stuff way back when, and, you know, law enforcement was pretty clueless. And when people called, you know, law, even the FBI, they didn't really have the mechanism to deal with this kind of stuff. So I am glad to see them doing that. When they say that they're doing this though, how does the law work to allow these agencies, and who can they target? I mean, who can you go after with this kind of stuff? If you're law enforcement, I mean, I'm going to ask about corporations too, but.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, the fact that these servers were located in Los Angeles is very notable. It's kind of weird that if you're a Hive, that you would have infrastructure located within the United States when you are targeting so many different United States entities. It doesn't appear, at least from my reading of the search warrant, that that is where it started. Like I said, they appeared to have been in Hive's network since at least July 2022. But I think the fact that these servers were located in the United States probably made it a lot easier for them to find them and for them to seize them and to sort of execute operations without Hive knowing. Seizing servers and infrastructure, that's become a much more important part of what the FBI has been doing in terms of going after ransomware gangs. The sort of gold standard always remains like, hey, get those guys in a courtroom, you know, get them arrested, get them extradited. But in lieu of that, if you can disrupt their infrastructure, most people will agree who kind of look at this issue that the disruption will be minor sort of at best. Nobody was really arrested here. And it's going to be relatively easy if you have money to replace a lot of that infrastructure. They got a court order seize those servers, to examine them for a whole host of things, and then eventually shut them down. That's sort of the bread and butter of what the FBI and law enforcement does around ransomware these days when they can't actually arrest the operators.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff seems like it kind of goes into that whack-a-mole problem, and that's far worse than like physical threats, because I mean, if you're setting up servers in the cloud and they're spread across the globe, and you know, I don't know that it's easy enough to arrest people. I know they did, this was in cooperation with Europol or somebody to try and get these servers. But yeah, I think pulling the servers down it's good, but I think they'll just put them right back up again with a different service, don't you think?
Yes. So I think the more impactful part here is the fact that the FBI basically stole, I think at least 1,000 decryption keys that they then passed on to at least 336 victims. And they claim that prevented them from paying $130 million in ransoms. And so that's real impact. And I think what's interesting about that is it's a very big difference from how the FBI responded when they had the decryption key for the Kaseya ransomware attack. And they wound up holding on to it for weeks, as you had all these businesses that had their data encrypted, that had to make the decision about whether to pay the ransom or negotiate with the ransomware actors. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has the decryptor, but the FBI was holding on to it because they wanted to use it in their investigative purposes. They wanted to use it for to conduct disruptive operations. And when that came out, they got hammered by Congress. They got hammered by the cybersecurity community for placing sort of their own institutional interests over helping victims. And there's this larger issue of like CISA coming and taking a big bite out of the FBI's cyber policy portfolio, largely because they are viewed by Congress and by other members of the community as a government entity that is more concerned with helping victims than in facilitating their investigation or sort of other sort of priorities. So I think this was like a really conscious, I think there's a bit of stagecraft by the FBI, they, you know, to sort of tell Washington and the public and businesses we get it. We screwed up with the Kaseya ransomware thing. We didn't emphasize victim recovery over our own interests. And we understand that's what you're, that you, what would you care about? And look at all the victims that we've been able to help using this. Aren't we someone that you should be reaching out to when you get hacked, when you get hit with ransomware? And so that's, I think, something that they did with an eye towards the way that businesses are communicating and looking at this issue, as well as how Congress looks at this issue when they're doling out authorities.
I mean, I think that's good. I mean, that's a very difficult thing in covert operation. I mean, there's like the I guess the famous example of that was the bombing of Coventry in England. When the Allies cracked the Enigma code, they knew that the Germans were going to bomb Coventry, and they could have announced, you know, there's a bombing raid coming, flee, and they didn't want to do that because then the Germans would have known that they had it. So I can see how you go down that road of, I don't want to reveal that we're in here, that we're in this network. But I also get mostly that the victims just say, hey, I just want my money back. I just want to, you know, I want to decrypt my systems and get out of this. I don't want to pay millions of dollars in ransom. How do you think that tailors into then the U.S. putting a bounty on ransomware? I mean, they're offering $10 million in like bounties from the U.S. government for people who can, I guess, give tips or provide disruption of these ransomware networks. Do you think that's going to just turn loose the vigilantes?
Yeah, I think when they're talking about that, it's my understanding is that it's much more about getting a sort of a tip, a traditional tip, the way that law enforcement will typically ask if you happen to know something about these actors, or maybe you happen to know something about their infrastructure that they use and rely on. I don't think it changes the sort of status quo that we have here where private companies are getting themselves in very sort of legally choppy waters if they want to, or individuals if they want to actually take the step of doing some kind of a hack or some type of activity that might run them afoul of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I don't think that status quo has changed. But I do think that the federal government is much more concerned with what ransomware groups are doing these days, and they're willing to pay millions of dollars if they can get a good tip, because you can see a good tip might let you infiltrate one of their networks. It might let you obtain decryptor keys. It might help you save American businesses and companies and other victims hundreds of millions of dollars. So from that perspective, it might be money well spent.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, it sounds like they're sort of slowly moving towards having better policies and better practices regarding this stuff. And I mean, I have no problem with them offering bounties on tips or whatever from this, because it's probably a good idea. I mean, that's how they deal with most everything, and they rely on that. You mentioned, you know, and corporate. I do think we should caution, you know, corporate people about going off down that road, you know, without sound legal advice, because if you want to tell everybody, the CFAA in the U.S. makes that pretty much illegal, right?
Yes. I mean, if you're talking about like straight up hacking back, that is currently illegal. I think right now where you are seeing a softening in how the Department of Justice approaches the use of the CFAA, it is softening much more in regards to the things that legitimate security researchers do to gain sort of visibility or awareness or to examine and discover vulnerabilities. It is still very much illegal to try and hack back at a group that is hacking you. And I think from a policy perspective, there was a push in some quarters. It was not a majority push. I think it's always been a minority position in Congress and other places that this is something that we should unleash companies to do. There was a bill that Representative Tom Graves introduced a few years ago that sort of kicked up this discussion again. It did not, get a whole lot of traction. Tom Graves is no longer in Congress anymore. My suspicion is that, I don't think that Congress in its current kind of makeup, particularly with Democratic Senate and a Republican House, and who are have a lot of other contentious issues. I'm very skeptical that any sort of change to that law is going to be in the offing here over the next few years, you know, because even relatively uncontroversial or straightforward cybersecurity regulations, things just as simple as you know, incident notification for critical infrastructure, even that is a really, you know, it was a really contentious issue. It took a long time to negotiate, and it took much longer to get through than it should have, given the details. So I can't see something like hacking back being you know, introduced or debated seriously in this Congress, but you know, we'll kind of have to see. We're still in early days.
Yeah, I mean, I was in a tabletop exercise years ago, and one of the people that was there was former Congressman Jim Langevin from Rhode Island, who was in the Cyber Caucus and all this. And there were a whole room full of attorneys participating in this thing. And there were people that were just gung-ho to, you know, immediately hack back in this scenario. And you know, and Jim was very much, you know, resistant to that. He was one of the people that were saying, we should not, you know, unleash the Kraken of all this. Could you see a kind of William Gibson kind of thing where, like, Mr. Foo's security based in Nigeria gets hired by Kentucky Fried Chicken to target, I'm sorry, KFC, to target Burger King? I think they're owned by the same company, but, you know, I mean, could you see that? I mean, I could see companies going down that road and saying, you know, the FBI is not going to help us in a timely fashion. We're just going to take it on ourselves. So we'll hire this foreign company to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's like the way that most policymakers and folks see it is we already are in a very, very messy landscape and environment where there's a whole lot of offensive and defensive cybersecurity activity happening across American businesses, happening across the government. It's a very noisy environment already with ransomware actors and state-sponsored groups and things like that. I don't think there's really much, if any, appetite to start adding a bunch of, you know, keyboard cowboys from, you know, private sector companies to start conducting their own operations where they probably have less visibility, they probably have less, fewer resources, and may probably not a really a strong grasp of what they can legally do and not do. So I think, you know, when it comes to this idea of hacking back, you know, what you saw yesterday is how certainly how the federal government would prefer that it be done, which is, you know, the law enforcement does it, where you can weigh the different equities between, you know, helping victims, gaining intelligence, furthering investigations, disrupting adversary infrastructure. I think that, you know, the government for the foreseeable future is going to prefer that those kinds of decisions and conversations happen within, you know, the federal agencies, within law enforcement, and that they're kind of contained there rather than letting companies just sort of make their own decisions or choices around that.
Awesome. Thank you, Derek Johnson from SC Media. And finally, well, layoffs have hit the tech industry hard if you've been under a rock. And if you are one of the many, and you know, I'm sorry that and it sucks. We've all been there, and it's never reduced the sucking factor. At least in my opinion, you know, we've all been laid off at some point, and it always is a drag. And I've seen some doozies, let me tell you. I used to work for a company, and we were going around and we were acquiring things, and I got my team got stuck going around and telling people they'd been laid off essentially with program, and I had 50 programmers who were getting laid off. And at the same time that day, there was a company news release that morning that started with austerity measures necessitate layoffs in tech division. It was a long time ago, so it's nobody current. But it also had this big headline on that same company newsletter that went out to everybody in the company that said something like, CEO rewarded with $10 million bonus for job well done. And, you know, and people got really irate. I mean, and that's awful. I'm like, who approved this nonsense? Like, you're laying people off at the same time? Well, here's a new one. Apparently, PagerDuty CEO Jennifer Tejada wrote an 11,000 or so word email to employees and basically told them they would be refining the operating model. And I love it when people let this kind of language sneak in, because it's so much better, you know, to tell people you're going to die than to tell them we're going to refine your life. You know, and I mean, they're basically telling they're going to cut 7% of worldwide staff, which is a refinement of the operating model. And I just hate it. They used to call those weasel words when I worked for the government because it's like really awful. But it keeps getting worse. I mean, this was just the first part of it. She then called all of the cuts in the email refinements. So poor word choice. But then in the same email went on to praise all the people that were being promoted and said they had had a great financial year and the results for Q4 were very strong and they expected another strong year this year. And then it gets even worse. Then she started quoting Martin Luther King. So, you know, it was, you should read this. It was probably the worst, and I've seen some doozies. Let me say it was probably the worst layoff announcement ever. So look, if you ever have to do this, try and be sensitive. And I mean, I know it's hard. I mean, me not being the most empathetic person around, you know, but don't brag about how much money you're making and how big of the bonuses were for the upper management and then turn around and tell people we've got to let you go for austerity. It's stupid. Even if it's the truth, it's still stupid. I mean, that's my sensitive comment on the matter. That's the news. Thanks, Derek Johnson. And we'll see you next week on the Security Weekly News.